Its very name denotes longevity. The establishment of the Permanent Fund was a progressive idea to save income from resource extraction to ensure our remote state would continue to have revenue to pay for state services long after oil and gas production ended. Fund managers say changes are needed to make sure it continues to be a resource for Alaskans long into the future. We'll learn about their recommendations and what current and former lawmakers want to happen today on Talk of Alaska. Hello, from Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. The idea was straightforward. In 1976, Alaskans voted on a constitutional amendment to create a permanent fund. And in 1982, the permanent fund dividend was established. It allowed every resident of Alaska to get an annual and equal share of the wealth derived from resource extraction. That first dividend was $1,000. The amount has fluctuated over the decades and has been at the center of heated debates. But a PFD has been paid every year. That sounds like great success, but does the expectation around the long-term citizen payout endanger the fund for its future intended purpose of paying for government services after oil income subsides? To find out what experts say is needed for long-term fund stability, we have with us today in the studio the CEO and Executive Director of the Permanent Fund Corporation, Devin Mitchell. Also in the studio is Anchorage Democrat Senator Bill Willikowski and former Anchorage Republican Representative Jennifer Johnston. Welcome, all of you. Thanks for being in the studio today.
Good to be here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You can also join us, Alaskans. What do you think is the best path forward to sustain the permanent fund for future generations? Do you think the PFD is a good idea? Should it be capped or ended? Do you think the state needs new revenue like taxes to ensure fiscal sustainability going forward? Okay, let's start off, Devin, by having you clarify for us the permanent fund accounts and how they are currently managed.
Sure. The Permanent Fund is managed by the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, which was created in 1980 for that specific purpose. And the mission we have is to maximize risk-adjusted return for the fund. And so there were some frameworks, statutory framework, built around how we could invest money at the corporation and how the earnings would be available for use by the state. And so initially, we could only invest money in fixed income securities. That's like bonds, where you get an investment, you hold it to maturity, you get regular interest payments from it, and then at the term, you get your money back. And that creates very, very regular realized income. Since that 1980 date, there's been a general progression towards a more sophisticated investment strategy that's focused on total return. So total return involves gains that aren't yet realized. So we earn money each and every year, but we haven't sold those investments yet. And so that money can't be spent. And that's the crux of the situation that we've been describing to Alaskans, that the earnings reserve account is where the realized earnings go. That's the money that's available for appropriation by the legislature. The unrealized earnings, they get pro rata allocated to the earnings reserve account and the principal, but they're not available to spend. They go away if the earnings reserve account realized earnings balance diminishes. Those pro rata unrealized gains that are assigned to the earnings reserve account go over to the principal portion. And so we're in a situation right now with some modest statutory net income years where there's a time horizon or a modeling probability that there won't be sufficient money in the earnings reserve account to make transfers to the state for use for a permanent fund or any other purpose, at least on a pro rata basis, so some portion.
And so when you're talking about unrealized gains, that's similar to equity in a home, correct? It's like, yes, there is money there, but it's not cash in hand.
That's correct. It's money that's earned as you, and that's a great example. You purchase your home for $100,000 and it goes up in value $10,000 for 10 years. Now it's worth $200,000. There were unrealized gains in each one of those years, but you can't actually take that money and spend it in that scenario until you sell your house. You could get a home equity line of credit. I mean, it's not like the money's not available to you, so I don't want to imply that the unrealized gains create some sort of inability to spend money, because we have plenty of liquidity within the fund, within the various asset allocations. It's really an accounting function. And at the current time, we have around $14 billion of those unrealized gains, which if they if we were to liquidate the portfolio, some portion of those would transfer over to the earnings reserve account. We're just not in a position that we want to liquidate because we wouldn't have maximized our return.
A significant shift happened in 2019 in how the fund's earnings are used. Describe that shift to percent of market value, the POMV as it's known, and what that means for how earnings are used.
Sure. So in 2014, the price of oil went from over 100, where it had been very stable for the prior two fiscal years, to something close to zero or negative in certain markets. Alaska North Slope, in my recollection, dipped to around $20 a barrel. That created that low oil price environment created a tremendous need for revenue. The Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund at that time was fairly robust. It was relied upon, as was intended, as a shock absorber to get us through those tough times. But in the course of that relatively long, low oil price environment, folks realized that we weren't going to be able to continue to rely on the CBR because it was reaching a zero. And so there was consideration of how to use the permanent fund. And what was determined was that a percent of market value draw was the most stable and best able to last in perpetuity model. And so we use a historical 5-year average balance, and we take 5% of that and make it available to the legislature and governor to decide how to use.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about the future of the permanent fund. In the studio with me today, we have Devin Mitchell, the CEO and Executive Director and CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Also in the studio is Anchorage Democrat Senator Bill Willikowski, and former Anchorage Republican Representative Jennifer Johnston is with us as well. Devin, one more question to you before I turn to our lawmakers here. In June, you warned lawmakers about the earnings reserve running out of money. Describe this concern and what you think lawmakers should do now to fix it.
So we had a bellwether experience this July 1, in as much as we've been talking about the earnings reserve account not being sufficient to potentially provide for the needs of the state. And we're really conservative in how we allocate the earnings reserve. So on July 1, we not only segregate the current fiscal year's percent of market value transfer, but we also identify the coming budget cycle. So the fiscal year 2026, the budget year that the legislature will be determining how to utilize this winter, is also segregated. And at the same time, we have inflation-proofing appropriations for the current fiscal year. The prior fiscal year's inflation-proofing would have happened the day before on June 30th. And so last year, we started the year, and after accounting for all of those things, we had about a $200 million balance in the earnings reserve account. This year, after accounting for all those things, we had inadequate balance by around $400 million. And so that was the first time that we've had a shortfall. And in our ability to identify money in the bank money available to provide for the needs that have been identified. And that's been a long trend of like I said, the unrealized gain balance is growing. The realized earnings over the course of the last several fiscal years have been fairly modest, and the result has been a diminishment of available funds for the legislature to use.
And so what do you want lawmakers to do?
It would be great if they would consider how to make the permanent fund more permanent in the current scenario where we do manage for total return. So I think the trustees have made clear in their historical writings, there's trustee papers that have been produced by our board of trustees. Since prior to 2000, they've been advocating for a one fund with a percent of market value, limited draw upon it. It would satisfy many of the long-term concerns revolving around the permanent fund. It would solidify an amount that would be available each and every year for the state that would be extraordinarily stable, and it offsets the volatility of oil revenue, which is our other primary revenue source. It would eliminate the potential of an overdraw of the fund because the fund would be better protected from. Right now, we have a construct where a simple majority of the legislature with concurrence of the governor could utilize any balance that's available in the earnings reserve account. That would be eliminated, so you wouldn't have that worry about one generation taking an unfair share of what's been built up by the past generations of Alaskans. And you would no longer have to worry about the inflation-proofing appropriations because we'd limit the draw to an amount in the Constitution that would be sustainable. And so it would hit on all cylinders, and that would be the preferred alternative. If that's not achievable because of the limitations of where we are, there's other statutory framework modifications that could be made that would fill as a stopgap for us to ensure that we had a high expectation, 100% expectation of being able to meet the needs of the state.
Thank you. Senator Willikowski, I want to turn to you now. You are against the idea that the corporation trustees have recommended to combine the earnings reserve with the main corpus. Why are you against this idea?
Well, I think it's important to go back and look at how we got in the situation that we're in. For decades, the state has been able to fund our budget with 90% through oil revenue. And so in 2013, the legislature passed legislation to massively cut the amount of oil revenue that we take in. And the promises that were made at that time were that we would get more investment from the oil industry, more jobs from the oil industry, more production, and more revenue to the state, and a growing PFD. Those are well documented. The oil industry spent tens of millions of dollars telling Alaskans that this is what we would get in exchange for giving them billions of dollars in tax breaks. And so we did this. And then within 6 months, we lost over $1 billion in oil revenue. Over the course of a year, we lost $2 billion in oil revenue. And ever since that time, we have been bleeding revenue. And as far as the other promises, jobs have been cut in half, investment's been cut in half by the oil industry. Production, we're supposed to get 1 million barrels a day, less than 500,000 barrels per day. And of course, so now instead of having the state budget funded 90% by the oil industry, which it was for decades, oil revenue now funds approximately 15 to 30% depending on the price of oil. And so how is that being made up? Well, it's no coincidence that the bill was passed in 2013. Within 3 years, we were hemorrhaging money, which led to Governor Walker vetoing the dividend. And we had a $16 billion savings account in 2013, and that money is virtually gone right now. We've blown through our entire savings. And it really is because we're not taking in the revenue that we expected. And so where's that money coming from? Well, it's coming from the permanent fund. It's coming from the dividend. Every man, woman, and child in the state of Alaska is effectively giving the oil industry $2,000 to $2,500 of their permanent fund dividend checks every single year to pay for tax credits, tax deductions, tax breaks, and things of that nature. And so I'm not supportive of making wholesale changes to the dividend, cutting Alaskans' dividends, taxing working Alaskans until we fix our oil revenues.
So it's not a matter of you not trusting the trustees then. It's a matter of you seeing this as, what, a distraction from what you see as the main problem, which is a need for more revenue from the oil industry?
I think that's a fair way to say it. Yeah, I don't distrust the trustees. I think they're professionals. I mean, this is something that they've advocated for many years, and I think when you get in a situation where you're taking away your one source of revenue that massively funds your state, and then cutting that, you have to find other sources. And so the state's unfortunately been unable to find other sources, and so it's been coming from the dividend. And I think that's fundamentally unfair to the people of Alaska, to the working families of Alaska who rely on that, rural Alaskans who rely on that. And I'd like to see other changes made before we go ahead and make wholesale changes to the way the dividend is, to the way the permanent fund is structured.
All right. Thank you. And Representative Johnson, I know you're a former representative, spent years in the legislature as well as on the Anchorage Assembly, almost a decade on the Assembly. What are your thoughts here? What do you think would be the best way forward for fiscal stability?
Well, first of all, I'm glad that we all agree that it would be good to combine the funds. It's always good to start with agreement. Secondly, I wasn't quite prepared, but I should have been, as far as the discussion, as far as oil taxes. And I'll probably have to lean on Devin a little bit, but historically, the 10 years that have passed, as Devin documented, have been the oil industry crashed, basically. And we now do have reinvestment in the state that I'm not sure if we would have had. And where I would need Devin is during COVID, I have a feeling that actually the new tax structure kind of saved us in revenue. But that being said, my interest in the permanent fund is stability and growth. And I think this is the best way to get to stability and growth is by having basically a true endowment fund. And it's interesting. I was very fortunate. I voted for the permanent fund in 1976, which shows you that, yes, I am now 70. But that being said, that election was no different than the discussions we're having now in one sense. The state was divided. It wasn't a complete, I mean, there was some pretty major figures in state history that were arguing against it.
Against the permanent fund?
Yes. And it was because they felt we had so many more immediate needs for that fund. And for that, we needed to build our infrastructure. We needed to grow our state. So the discussion between the short term and the long term has always been there and should be there for a long time. It keeps everybody on their toes. But it is interesting. It's the same discussion, just different aspects of what a short-term and long-term look is.
And so to both of you as former and current lawmakers, the original idea was, hey, the oil isn't going to last forever. We need money for the future. Do you think a cap on the amount of the permanent fund dividend would have been a good idea when it was put in place?
Well, I don't. If you go back, and I did quite a bit of research several years ago on this, there were a number of different reasons why the permanent fund was created. And as Representative Johnson mentioned, there was a fair degree of dispute. There were a number of politicians who wanted to get their hands on that money. And over the years, ever since the permanent fund dividend was created, there have been attempts to get rid of it by either legislators or governors nonstop. In fact, it was passed by Governor Hammond and Governor Sheffield took over. And one of the first things he tried to do was to get rid of the dividend because politicians have always thought they know better what to do with this money. And when you look back, what some of the reasons that were discussed for the creation of the dividend were, you have all this money coming in. I mean, put this in perspective. When Prudhoe Bay was discovered, Alaska was expecting to get maybe $50 million, $100 million in royalty when we put it out for a bid. They got $900 million. That was at a time when our state budget was about $150 million a year. It was an enormous amount of money. And so politicians were saying, well, hey, we've got to do something. And by the way, that $900 million was completely blown within 5 or 6 years. And so the public was very concerned. Hey, we've got to do something there. And at the time, there was really no consensus about how this money would be saved. They knew they were getting a massive amount of tax money would be coming in, royalty money would be coming in. And so some of the discussion at the time, if you go back and look at the minutes, there were a few different themes. Number one was income inequality. And Alaska, in the last few years, we're no longer number one, but we're still up there, has some of the lowest income inequality in the United States. That was very important to the founders of the dividend. The other thing that was really important was this concept that everyone get a share. And there you see this a lot in government, is that you have all this money pouring in, and those who are politically connected, those who are big campaign contributors, somehow figure out a way to get more share, a larger share of that money that's coming into government than the average person. And so what the founders of the dividend wanted was very important to them, was that every single Alaskan get a piece of that, that this is our money that belongs to all Alaskans. We have a very unique constitution. No other state in the United States has it. We own the subsurface rights under the Statehood Act, and we have a constitutional obligation to get the maximum value for the resource and maximum value for the people. And so the way that they thought would best accomplish that requirement would be to give every single Alaskan, every man, woman, and child, a share, a small sliver. And, you know, the government gets 100% of the royalties, 100% of the production taxes, 100% of the property taxes. And we get a royalty of typically about 12.5%, and government gets 75% of that. And so you've got this very small percentage. It's roughly 3.25% of the total value of the oil goes to the people. And it's been extraordinarily managed. It's probably one of the most popular political programs in Alaska, if not the United States. And the Permanent Fund Corporation has done a phenomenal job managing that for the people. But now we're at this crossroads where we've got to figure out how do we move forward from here? And that's been the debate that we've been having for years.
So the idea about capping the permanent fund dividend just isn't appealing to you. You think, is that part of what keeps people engaged?
I think the idea behind the dividend is to keep people, absolutely. When I talked to Rick Alford and I talked to Clem Tillion and I used to talk to Jay Hammond when he was around, that was the idea behind it. They needed the dividend. There was a tremendous concern that if you got rid of the dividend, the permanent fund would effectively go away.
Well, and I want your thoughts too, Representative Johnson, but the flip side of that is, if people don't have to pay taxes, and you know, no one likes taxes, but revenue is a necessity if you're going to run a state. And so the flip side of not paying taxes, being paid to be a resident, could be that people aren't as engaged enough in how the government is being run, because they're like, what do I care? I'm not paying taxes. Do you have concerns about that also being part of that could be a problem, that people don't have skin in the game, they're just not as engaged to force these changes and decisions that need to be made? Because every year as you said, it's like Groundhog Day every year.
Well, I think this was something that Governor Hammond talked about, and his idea was that the way you're going to keep people engaged was through the dividend, mm-hmm. and that you would create this militant band of people, and if you tried to take their dividend away, they would respond accordingly. And that is what we've seen. People are, you talk to people, they're very passionate about the permanent fund.
Yes, they are. Representative Johnson.
Okay. it's interesting. First of all, historical perspective, the first dividend, Jay Hammond also, and others, felt that it was being vested in Alaska. And so the first dividend, as many of you might know, was $50 a year, unless you were here before statehood, and it was $1,000, and it was up to $1,000. And then he was told that that would have constitutional problems, and it did end up having constitutional problems. But that was very, very important to him. The other aspect of this is, yes, we have all had people, my dividend, my services. So it's not just a dividend. They don't want any cuts to their roads. They don't want any cuts to their their health benefits, any cuts to schools. I mean, so you've got that.
Therein lies the dilemma.
Right. So two things, if I can take a little time here. One is through Commonwealth North, Cheryl Fraska and I have done this Budget Matters online platform to engage people in the discussion and have people make their choices. What's more important? You know, what would you cut to get your dividend? And we redid it this year. In the past, we actually got some pretty good engagement. This year, the interest isn't there as much as it was, which I found was quite interesting because we actually went out and did more publicly to engage interest, and people were somewhat tired. So that was interesting to me. In counterbalance to my colleague next to me, I'm a one-trick pony. It's always been about fiscal management and balanced budget, and it makes me a very boring person. But in my public sector, I was one who really felt we should pay the dividend we could afford. In other words, it was a reverse tax. Since we don't pay taxes, it would hold the legislature accountable and the administration on their budget, because you'd want to budget to the largest dividend you could give the people. And that's true engagement. And I would counter to the senator here, I think we would maybe find better engagement that in taxes, which I am not in favor of taxes at this point until we balance the budget. And yes, we have balanced the budget the last 2 years with high oil and income, but I'm not sure we should depend on that. So anyways, that is the way you get in engagement to me. But it's politically difficult.
All right. On that note, we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the future of the Permanent Fund and what the best way forward may be to help it be sustainable long into the future as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today, we're discussing the future of the Permanent Fund. In the studio with me, we have Devin Mitchell, the Executive Director and CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Also in the studio is Anchorage Democrat Senator Bill Willikowski, and former Anchorage Republican Representative Jennifer Johnston is with us. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Les Guerra is in Anchorage. Hello, another former representative.
Yeah, thank you, Laurie. Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks, Bill, for doing this. You know, I think the problem is we're on high center. I think there's everybody on your panel wants a better state. We all want a better state. The math does not work. So we're still at a point where nobody's moved their position since 2012. And what's that gotten us? For the side that wants a $1,000 dividend, it's not going to work. The public doesn't believe in it. So you can keep telling people, all you get is a $1,000 dividend. Even if I agreed with that, which I don't, but even if I agreed with that, I have to recognize the public is not there. You have to go where the public is. You have to meet people where they are. And then when Jennifer says, and she is, she was a very thoughtful legislator. When Jennifer says we can only afford pay the dividend we can afford, that's true. Well, when you undertax oil by $800 million to $1 billion a year, you can afford a smaller dividend. So is it the dividend we can afford with a fair oil tax, which would be much bigger, or is it the dividend we can afford by giving away our oil? Most states on their property, they charge a close to a 20% royalty for the oil that comes out of their ground for state oil. We charge a 12.5% royalty. So over 50% more is what most states charge. In Texas, where private landowners negotiate their royalty, they negotiate a 25% royalty roughly. Double what Alaska does. We're giving away our oil. So the answer is, really, if your answer is we can never ask for a fair share for oil because we've been an oil colony for 50 years and we let them dictate our politics, if that's your answer, you will never have a dividend that the public will accept. But if you decide you're going to sort of stand up for the sovereignty of the people in the state, and I was friends with Jay Hammond, and as a friend of Jay Hammond, I would say none of us get to say what he would say. None of us get to say what he would say. But what he used to tell me when we'd sit down for coffee at my house is, first you get a fair share for your oil, because that taxes the wealthiest and most privileged, the people who can afford it the easiest. Then you get an income tax on high earners. if you haven't solved the budget deficit. And then you go to the dividend. Jake Hammond was not opposed to doing all three. He was opposed to doing it where you go, you hit the people who rely on the dividend the most first without going to the other places.
Mm-hmm.
So fair share for our oil. Look, on both sides, the folks who say in a high oil price year, we should be paying a $4,000 dividend and underfund our schools, I think that's insane, okay? But those who keep pushing the $1,000 dividend, you know, when Bill Walker did that, I disagreed with it because it was not with public input. I knew the public was going to rebel, and they did. A $1,000 dividend, whether you or I want it, and higher income people like the $1,000 dividend, right? Because it doesn't hurt them. If you go to Nome or if you go to Fairview in Anchorage, those people in those areas, they rely on that money for groceries and gas and to get their kids what their kids need. So the dividend is not party-based. The dividend is income-based.
Right.
Lower-income people want a higher dividend.
All right.
You have to come up with an amount that is acceptable, something in the area of $2,000, $2,200 guaranteed that grows and that grows at high oil price years, but you need other revenue to pay for it. And the other revenue is the one that the public always accepts in polling, which is a fair share for our oil. When the oil initiative lost 2 years ago, it was based on the public's perception that that should be changed in the legislature, not by initiative. That they didn't agree with it.
You got to change
the discussion.
Thank you so much for your call and your comments. Representative Johnson, I want to turn to you. Senator Wilkowski has made this point, too, about more taxes on the oil industry. We often hear comparisons between other states and what their tax rate is. And then we hear from the industry side that it's more expensive to produce oil here. How much of that do you think holds up, and how do you respond to former Representative Guerra's comments?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I guess because this is public radio, I can talk about a book I read a long time ago.
I'm sure you can.
Anyways, I'm not sure if folks are familiar with Thomas Friedman, New York Times columnist, and he wrote "The World Is Flat," he wrote a follow-up book was "The World Was Flat, Hot, and Crowded," and in that book there is a chapter on third world nations, and it was an interesting chapter to read as an Alaskan, because what happened? Third world nations, resource rich third world nations. And what happens is you have just gobs of money coming in because of the resource. And be honest with you, yes, the politicians, the public, everybody, and everybody's responsible, they spend like banshees. And I've been in Alaskan history where we've spent like banshees and no accountability. And when that income starts dropping, and ours dropped for many reasons, and lack of development was one, which some of that's coming back now, but it's never going to be like it was. The first reaction is go after the income source. You go after where the money's been coming in, and we want more. We want our fair share. Never said that when the money was just coming in bucket loads. And there were a lot of irresponsible decisions and a lot of, you know, Senator Wilkowski talks about well-connected people and politicians and whatever you want. There was
that disconnect, though, between our rate of 12%, Texas 25%. Does that seem okay?
I think if you probably balance out the cost of doing business, the cost of other taxations, you might find it does. And as I say, if I'd been prepared, and I should have been, for this discussion, I was thinking my usual budget and permanent fund.
Well, yes, and I do want to get back to some of the tenets there.
You know, and I actually would defer to Devin for some of this because he spent some time with this in his previous job, and I'd rather confront it with facts than my memory.
Well, Devin, turning back to you now, we've been hearing this idea about oil taxes, but
going back to the tenets of the actual permanent fund and the differing pots of money that are within it, describe how the earnings reserve account and the constitutional budget reserve, we hear about the ERA and the CBR a lot, how are they different?
So the permanent fund was created in 1976 by constitutional amendment that provided that basically 25% of the resource royalty revenue of the state of Alaska would be saved in perpetuity. The state experienced the gobs of money thing for a period of time when oil started flowing through the Trans-Alaska pipeline, and there were excessive budgets in the early 1980s, and then the price of oil dropped in 1985-86. There were some extraordinary things done in that time. You mentioned Rick Halford earlier, and he reminded me that in those years of diminished revenue and a incredible recession in the state of Alaska, the classic boom and bust recession, they transferred the available balance of the earnings reserve account, which is, like we said, the realized earnings that are available for appropriation of the legislature with a majority vote, to the principal. So they sacrificed something when they did that because the state was in a really bad place. And so people recognized, the policymakers recognized, that we needed some other means of dealing with the volatility of oil price. And so the Constitutional Budget Reserve was created by another constitutional amendment in the early 1990s. And it provided that when the state entered into litigation surrounding oil and gas royalty revenue, that any settlements derived from that litigation would flow into the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund rather than the general fund. And there were some fairly large settlements in the time frame immediately thereafter that initially funded the CBR, and then it's acted as that shock absorber, because that's exactly what it is you've had this volatility in oil prices through the 1990s, and those were very austere years as well. The CBR was able to provide for a more stable outflow of revenues from the state and the economy that I think everybody that's come to Alaska since the 1990s has enjoyed, that there's been a stability, there's been kind of a at least moderate growth type environment that we've been in since that time frame, and in large part because of that decision.
So the idea that fund managers have put forward is get rid of all these various accounts and just make one main account. Is that correct?
It wouldn't have anything to do with the CBR. It would really just be
the earnings reserve.
Yeah, the permanent fund, which has, by statute, this isn't a constitutional construct. It's a statutory construct where we have the earnings reserve account, which is where the funds that have been realized, the earnings that have been realized accountancy-wise, reside, because all the money is just invested in the asset allocation of the permanent fund still. We don't segregate money into a different account. We have one asset allocation, but that money is what's available for our policy folks to appropriate or consider using.
If that happened, is there risk of then the permanent fund is, you know, there's been like this forbidden wall in front of the main corpus of the fund that you can never touch it unless it's, you know, some enormous emergency and there's a constitutional amendment or something else. Do you have concerns that by combining the funds and now we're just operating from the main corpus, that there's additional vulnerabilities that come into play with the main corpus?
Personally, I don't believe so. If you look back over the years since the percent of market value was put in place, so that's, again, a historical five-year average of the fund, a 5% draw of that amount has been made available. There's been, and initially it was a little bit higher, it was 5.5, then 5.25, then 5. And that revenue stream has been extraordinarily stable. If you look back over the same time frame at the earnings model, the 21% of the last 5 years, last completed fiscal year's earnings, you would have had larger payouts, and you would have had more volatility in those payouts to the tune of up to $1 billion a year from one fiscal year up or down to the next. And so to me, that model of relying on realized earnings isn't necessarily as durable as a POMV model where you have that expectation each and every year you're going to be able to meet your funding need.
All right, we are going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion on the future of the permanent fund as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Let's go to the phones again for a moment. Steve is in Anchorage. Hello. Steve?
Hello.
Yes, you're on.
Oh, okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. My question is, why isn't the permanent fund dividend means tested like virtually every other government support program so that it's only provided to those who truly need it? But by doing so, you probably would be able to provide a full statutory dividend without having to get into this brouhaha that we do every year about the size of the PFD. That's my question. Thanks for taking it.
All right. Thanks for the call, Steve. So Steve's proposing an idea that has been put forward before, sort of like a sliding scale, perhaps, of income, where if you're making higher income, you don't get as much, or maybe not a PFD at all. Seems like that might have some statutory or some constitutional problems. Senator Wilikowski, your thoughts about something like that?
It's certainly something that's people have proposed in the past. Not something that I support for a variety of reasons. I think, again, going back to the idea behind the dividend, it fundamentally is this idea that as an Alaskan, as Alaskans, we all have a right to a share of our oil wealth. And when you change that from saying, as an Alaskan, we have a constitutional obligation to get the maximum value for the resource, we have a constitutional obligation to provide the maximum value to the maximum benefit to the people, you're taking away that ownership share, that ownership philosophy, that ownership thought, and making it an entitlement program. Mm. And I think that just fundamentally changes the nature of the dividend. And sure, is it fair that millionaires get it? Maybe people are making a lot of money. They probably don't need it, but it just fundamentally changes the nature of the dividend. And I think, I just don't think that's in our best interest to do that.
Well, in the lawsuit that came in about the residency requirement, where there was a lawsuit that said it's not constitutional to say you get paid a certain amount for every year you've lived here. Wouldn't that sort of cover something like this as well?
Yeah, I would say that. I'm not an attorney like Senator Wilikowski, so I would rather but I think there could be some constitutional issues with it.
I think constitutionally, I mean, it'd be a rational basis test. Is there a rational basis to have a means test? I think legally you probably could do it.
Interesting.
I think you'd require a statutory change. And look, we haven't been able to agree on any statutory changes to the dividend. So I think it's politically a difficult road to hoe. And I think philosophically, it fundamentally changes the nature of the permanent fund in a way that I don't know is in our best interest.
So we had an email from Carol who says, I'm listening to your discussion and the proposal to change the method of drawdown. The finance profession is pretty new, the 1950s. So there has been a lot of learning, she writes. When the statute was established, pulling from realized earnings was best practice. But in the 80s, I believe it was Yale University, began managing from a total endowment perspective, drawing a small percent of funds from the total balance. The endowment method is now considered best practice. She says, I agree with the argument that we have to get budget house in order, but one should not prevent a positive change to a best practice to be held hostage. So we've been talking about, a constitutional amendment of various kinds. Last April, the Alaska House said no to a constitutional amendment that would have enshrined the PFD, the permanent fund dividend, in the Constitution, guaranteeing an annual payout. The final vote was 22-18, so it was in play. So here we are, again, in this place where there's people that are looking on both sides almost equally to do something, but can't decide on the way forward. Senator Wilkowski, how do you think there can be progress made on this in January?
I think it's important for voters to ask the candidates where specifics, really detailed, granular specifics about where they stand on the dividend, how they intend to pay for a dividend. You know, you hear a lot of candidates say, well, I support a full dividend, full statutory dividend. The next important question is, how are you going to pay for it? And if it's cuts, if you have legislators saying, well, we're going to cut, like certain people have said, let's see where you're going to cut. Where are you going to cut a couple billion dollars? And if you have legislators who say, well, I want to increase revenue, ask them to follow up. Where's the revenue going to come from? Is it going to be an income tax, a sales tax? I mean, where is it going to come from? Oil taxes? I think those. It's important for Alaskans to get engaged. You know, what we've seen and I ask this question on my surveys to my constituents all the time. Do you support a permanent fund? Absolutely. Like my constituents support putting in the Constitution. They support a full statutory dividend. However, when you ask them the follow-up, how do you want to pay for it? There's no agreement on how to pay for it. And so this is the challenge that we face in this state is we haven't come to that consensus on how we're going to get there. I mean, I certainly have my ideas and you know, I've been able to get there. And I know Governor Dunleavy had his ideas, and his ideas was we're going to cut government, and he couldn't get there. And so it requires compromise. But in the meantime, as we're having this debate, what Alaskans are seeing is their dividend decrease every year. What they're seeing is us get into a situation where, as Devin said before, we are perilously close. I mean, I think within the next 5 to 10 years, it is highly, highly likely. Once you see a stock market crash, once you see oil prices dropping even more, it is highly likely that you're going to be in a situation where you can't afford, you will not have enough money to pay for government or a dividend.
So, Devin, it seems rare that someone in your position, we don't hear often from the fund managers, certainly not from you in public speaking very often. What prompted you agreeing to this? Would you say it's your level of concern? Are you hoping to help educate Alaskans about we really need to do something here? And then what's your plan now going forward to January to try to help break things loose to see some movement?
That's a excuse me, a great question. I think that it is outside. If you look at our mandate, like I said earlier, the Permanent Fund Corporation's mandate is to maximize the risk-adjusted rate of return. We don't have any mandate to ensure there's money available for a percent of market value transfer to the state based on a statutory construct. So there's a bit of a disconnect. But from a policy perspective, I personally, and I think our organization, feels obligated to ensure that the legislature is aware of the potential failure of the current construct, given the evolution in the financial markets, both in fund accounting as well as the investment of the permanent fund balance, that's leading us towards that failure, and the modeling, probabilistic modeling, 1 out of 20 times in the next 10 years, and so that's a fairly statistically significant potential that people should be discussing. And in a worst case scenario where it happens, not obviously in fiscal year 2026, because that money set aside, although we did see the inability to fully fund inflation proofing for 2025, but if we had a low statutory net income year, realized earnings income year in fiscal year 2025, then it could become to where we're relying on current year earnings to provide for the percent of market value transfer, which is just a place that we'd rather not be if we had our druthers.
And are you, I'm not a stock market expert by any stretch, but I've heard people saying, can't keep going up. There's going to be a huge adjustment at some point. Are you concerned about that and how that could affect the earnings reserve?
That's something that's probably more of a concern for an individual that's been investing and benefiting from some of the exuberance that you see in like the S&P 500. The permanent funds asset allocation is a lot more diverse than that. And so we have a targeted rate of return of inflation plus 5%. And we want to have stability in that return. And so we don't have the same exposures that a lot of folks might have in their private portfolios. But certainly we do have risk, additional risk, with the construct that we have, because we invest in what are called private markets, which have less liquidity, things like real estate, private equity, private income, private credit, private infrastructure. And so those investments are long-lived, similar to your home, and there's not a good secondary market for getting your value out on a short-term basis. On a long-term basis, we expect outperformance to public markets. And if there were a big correction in the public equity space, we are hedged against that a little bit in the strategies that we have laid on the portfolio and the public equity asset class. But certainly everybody would sink a little bit. And as a result of that, it would bring forward that discussion about the that concern, the 1 in 20 chance. That would be maybe the 1 in 20 chance that we have, depending on the type of market scenario that you enter into.
But primarily, the permanent fund is not invested in a way that it's subject to such erratic whims of the steep up and down.
It's definitely more moderated compared to an individual that might have been buying the Magnificent Seven stocks or growth stocks.
Okay, thank you. Representative Johnson, former Representative Johnson, I want to give you the final word here. You're not in the legislature any longer, but certainly I know that you're very active in working on things, talking to former colleagues, talking to constituents and citizens. What are you going to be pushing for in the lead up to January? And are you concerned that we might be heading into some type of crisis before something really happens?
I'm a perennial optimist, so hopefully not. I think the way to explain this is we want our fund to grow. And if we keep going in this direction, they can't manage the fund to grow. They're going to have to manage the fund for draws. And that then means that it's going to go progressively, or it could go progressively down with little ups. 2008, we almost did not have the funds to pay a dividend because the market had performed well, too well, so it crashed. And the funds, the liquid funds, which is what you need. You can always get liquid funds by selling, but then you lose your investment. Mm-hmm. So for the people of Alaska, and I'm a mother of three, grandmother of seven, looking forward to many more years. I think we need to do this for the long term.
All right. Thank you to my guests today. But before I get to the guests, I want to just say we had one more email by Sophie who says, I think we should increase taxation on every form of industry. Extraction and mining should also be paying into the permanent fund. Our state lands are being solicited on a grand scale. Many industries are stampeding in, and there's no real relationship with the Alaska tribes, only the corporations who have land titles. We need tribal consultations with state agencies. We should be taxing the rich companies who are pursuing these developments. That was from Sophie. And I want to say thank you to our guest today, Devin Mitchell, the executive director and CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Anchorage Democrat Senator Bill Wilikowski was also in the studio with us today, as was former Anchorage Republican Representative Jennifer Johnston. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, and on the phones, Ava White helped us out today. Thanks for listening. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.